Side 7, Sphere, by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 284. Remember your idea that the sphere might strike us below the belt? Norman said. The way the AIDS virus strikes our immune system below the belt? AIDS hits us at a level we aren't prepared to deal with. So, in a sense, does the sphere. Because we believe that we can think whatever we want without consequence. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me? We have sayings like that, which emphasize the point. But now, suddenly, a name is as real as a stick, and it can hurt us in the same way. Our thoughts get manifested. What a wonderful thing, except that all our thoughts get manifested, the good ones and the bad ones. And we simply aren't prepared to control our thoughts. We've never had to do it before. When I was a child, Beth said, I was angry with my mother, and when she got cancer, I was terribly guilty. Yes, Norman said, children think this way. Children all believe that their thoughts have power. But we patiently teach them that they're wrong to think that. Of course, he said, there has always been another tradition of belief about thoughts. The Bible says not to covet your neighbor's wife, which we interpret to mean that the act of adultery is forbidden, but that's not really what the Bible is saying. The Bible is saying that the thought of adultery is as forbidden as the act itself. And Harry, do you know anything about Jungian psychology? Beth said, that stuff has never struck me as relevant. Well, it's relevant now, Norman said. He explained. Jung broke with Freud early in this century and developed his own psychology. Jung suspected there was an underlying structure to the human psyche that was reflected in an underlying similarity to our myths and archetypes. One of his ideas was that everybody had a dark side to his personality, which he called the shadow. The shadow contained all the unacknowledged personality aspects, the hateful parts, the sadistic parts, all that. Jung thought people had the obligation to become acquainted with their shadow side, but very few people do. We all prefer to think we're nice guys, and we don't ever have the desire to kill and maim and rape and pillage. Yes, as Jung saw it, if you didn't acknowledge your shadow side, it would rule you. So we're seeing Harry's shadow side? In a sense, yes. Harry needs to present himself as Mr. Arrogant, Know-It-All Black Man, Norman said. He certainly does. So if he's afraid to be down here in this habitat, and who isn't, then he can't admit his fears. But he has the fears anyway, whether he admits them or not. And so his shadow side justifies the fears, creating things that prove his fears to be valid. The squid exists to justify his fears? Something like that, yes. I don't know, Beth said. She leaned back and turned her head up, and her high cheekbones caught the light. She looked almost like a model, elegant and handsome and strong. I'm a zoologist, Norman. I want to touch things and hold them in my hands and see that they're real. All these theories about manifestations, they're so psychological. The world of the mind is just as real and follows rules just as rigorous as the world of external reality, Norman said. Yes, I'm sure you're right, but, she shrugged, it isn't very satisfying to me. You know everything that has happened since we got down here, Norman said. Tell me another hypothesis that explains it all. I can't, she admitted. I've been trying all the time you've been talking. I can't. She folded the paper in her hands and considered it for a while. You know, Norman, I think you've made a brilliant series of deductions. Absolutely brilliant. I'm seeing you in a whole different light. Norman smiled with pleasure. For most of the time he had been down in the habitat, he'd felt like a fifth wheel, an unnecessary person in this group. Now someone was acknowledging his contribution, and he was pleased. Thank you, Beth. She looked at him, her large eyes liquid and soft. You're a very attractive man, Norman. I don't think I ever really noticed before. Absently, she touched her breast beneath the clinging jumpsuit. Her hands pressed the fabric, outlining the hard nipples. She suddenly stood and hugged him, her body close to him. "We have to stay together on this," she said. "We have to stay close, you and I."
"Yes, we do."
"Because if what you are saying is true, then Harry is a very dangerous man."
"Yes."
"Just the fact that he is walking around fully conscious makes him dangerous."
"Yes."
"What are we going to do about him?"
"Hey, you guys," Harry said, coming up the stairs. "Is this a private party, or can anybody join in?"
"Sure," Norman said. "Come on up, Harry." And he moved away from Beth.
"Was I interrupting something?" Harry said.
"No, no.
I don't want to get in the way of anybody's sex life."
"Oh, Harry," Beth said. She sat at the lab bench, moving away from Norman.
"Well, you two sure look all charged up about something."
"Do we?" Norman said.
"Yeah, especially Beth. I think she gets more beautiful every day she's down here."
"I've noticed that, too," Norman said, smiling.
"I bet you have. A woman in love. Lucky you."
Harry turned to Beth.
"Why are you staring at me like that?"
"I'm not staring," Beth said.
"You are, too." "Harry, I'm not staring."
"I can tell when someone is staring at me, for Christ's sake."
Norman said, "Harry,
I just want to know why you two are looking at me like that. You're looking at me like I'm a criminal or something."
"Don't get paranoid, Harry."
"Huddling up here, whispering?"
"We weren't whispering."
"You were."
Harry looked around the room.
"So, it's two white people and one black person now, is that it?"
"Oh, Harry.
I'm not stupid, you know. Something's going on between you. I can tell."
"Harry," Norman said, "nothing is going on." And then they heard a low, insistent beeping from the communications console downstairs. They exchanged glances and went downstairs to look. The console screen was slowly printing out letter groups.
CQX, VDX, MOP, LKI.
"Is that Jerry?" Norman asked.
"I don't think so," Harry said. "I don't think he would go back to code."
"Is it a code?"
"I would say so, definitely."
"Why is it so slow?" Beth said.
A new letter was added every few seconds in a steady, rhythmic way.
"I don't know," Harry said.
"Where is it coming from?"
Harry frowned.
"I don't know, but the transmission speed is the most interesting characteristic. The slowness.
Interesting."
Norman and Beth waited for him to figure it out. Norman thought, "How can we ever get along without Harry? We need him. He is both the most important intelligence down here and the most dangerous. But we need him."
CQX, VDX, MOP, LKI, XXC, VRW, TGK, TIU, YQA.
"Interesting," Harry said.
"The letters are coming about every 5 seconds, so I think it's safe to say that we know where it's coming from. Wisconsin."
Norman could not have been more surprised.
"Wisconsin?"
"Yeah, this is a Navy transmission. It may or may not be directed to us, but it is coming from Wisconsin."
"How do you know that?"
"Because that's the only place in the world it could be coming from," Harry said. "You know about ELF? No? Well, it's like this. You can send radio waves through the air, and as you know, they travel pretty well. But you can't send radio far through water. Water is a bad medium, so you need an incredibly powerful signal to go even a short distance."
"Yes.
But the ability to penetrate is a function of wavelength. An ordinary radio wave is short. Short wave radio, all of that. The length of the waves are tiny, thousands or millions of little waves to an inch. But you can also make ELF, extremely low frequency waves, which are long. Each individual wave is maybe 20 feet long. And those waves, once generated, will go a very great distance, thousands of miles, through water, no problem. The only trouble is that, since the waves are long, they're also slow.
That's why we're getting one character every 5 seconds. The Navy needed a way to communicate with their submarines underwater, so they built a big ELF antenna in Wisconsin to send these long waves, and that's what we're getting.
And the code?
It must be a compression code. Three-letter groupings which stand for a long section of predefined message, so it won't take so long to send a message. Because if you sent a plain text message, it would literally take hours.
CQX, VDX, MOP, LKI, XXC, VRW, TGK, PIU, YQA, IYT, EEQ, FVC, ZNB, TMK, EXE, MMN, OPW, GEW. The letters stopped.
Looks like that's it, Harry said.
How do we translate it? Beth said.
Assuming it's a Navy transmission, Harry said, we don't.
Maybe there's a code book here somewhere, Beth said.
Just hold on, Harry said. The screen shifted, translating groups one after another. 2340 hours, 7-07, Chief Sync Compact to Barnes, DPAB 8.
It's a message to Barnes, Harry said.
They watched as the other letter groups were translated. Surface support vessels steaming Nandi and Vipati to your location, ETA, 1600 hours, 7-08. Deep withdraw, auto set. Acknowledge. Good luck. Spalding. End.
Does that mean what I think it means? Beth said.
Yeah, Harry said. The cavalry is on the way.
Hot damn!
Beth clapped her hands. The storm must be calming down. They've sent the surface ships, and they'll be here in a little more than 16 hours.
An auto set?
They had the answer immediately. Every screen in the habitat flickered. In the upper right corner of each appeared a small box with numbers. 16, 20, 00. The numbers ran backward.
It's automatically counting down for us.
Is there some kind of countdown we're supposed to follow for leaving the habitat? Beth said. Norman watched the numbers. They were rolling backward just as they had on the submarine. Then he said, "What about the submarine?"
"Who cares about the submarine?" Harry said.
"I think we should keep it with us," Beth said. She checked her watch. "We have another 4 hours before it has to be reset."
"Plenty of time."
"Yes." Privately, Norman was trying to gauge whether they could survive for 16 more hours. Harry said, "Well, this is great news. Why are you two so hangdog?"
"Just wondering if we'll make it," Norman said.
"Why shouldn't we make it?" Harry said.
"Jerry might do something first," Beth said.
Norman felt a burst of irritation with her. Didn't she realize that by saying that she was planting the idea in Harry's mind?
"We can't survive another attack on the habitat," Beth said.
Norman thought, "Shut up, Beth. You're making suggestions."
"An attack on the habitat?" Harry said.
Quickly, Norman said, "Harry, I think you and I should talk to Jerry again."
"Really? Why?"
"I want to see if I can reason with him."
"I don't know if you can," Harry said. "Reason with him."
"Let's try anyway," Norman said with a glance at Beth. "It's worth a try." Norman knew he would not really be talking to Jerry. He would be talking to a part of Harry. An unconscious part. A shadow part. How should he go about it? What could he use? He sat in front of the monitor screen, thinking, "What do I know about Harry, really?" Harry, who had grown up in Philadelphia as a thin, introverted, painfully shy boy, a mathematical prodigy, his gifts denigrated by his friends and family. Harry had said once that when he cared about mathematics, everybody else cared about slam dunking. Even now, Harry hated all games, all sports. As a young man, he had been humiliated and neglected, and when he finally got proper recognition for his gifts, Norman suspected, it came too late. The damage was already done. Certainly it came too late to prevent the arrogant, braggart exterior. "I am here. Do not be afraid."
"Jerry."
"Yes, Norman."
"I have a request to make."
"You may do so."
"Jerry, many of our entities are gone.
and our habitat is weakened. I know this. Make your request. Would you please stop manifesting?
No.
Why not? I do not wish to stop.
Well, Norman thought, at least we got right down to it. No wasting time.
Jerry, I know that you have been isolated for a long time, for many centuries, and that you have felt alone during all that time. You have felt that nobody cared about you. You have felt that nobody wanted to play with you or shared your interests.
Yes, this is true.
And now at last you can manifest and you are enjoying this. You like to show us what you can do to impress us.
This is true.
So that we will pay attention to you.
Yes, I like it.
And it works. We do pay attention to you.
Yes, I know it.
But these manifestations injure us, Jerry.
I do not care.
And they surprise us, too.
I am glad.
We're surprised, Jerry, because you are merely playing a game with us.
I do not like games. I do not play games.
Yes, this is a game for you, Jerry. It is a sport.
No, it is not.
Yes, it is, Norman said. It is a stupid sport.
Harry, standing beside Norman, said, You want to contradict him that way? You might make him mad. I don't think Jerry likes to be contradicted.
I'm sure you don't, Norman thought. But he said, Well, I have to tell Jerry the truth about his own behavior. He isn't doing anything very interesting.
Oh? Not interesting?
No, you are being spoiled and petulant, Jerry.
Do you dare to speak to me in this fashion?
Yes, because you are acting stupidly.
Jeez, Harry said, take it easy with him.
I can easily make you regret your words, Norman. Norman was noticing, in passing, that Jerry's vocabulary and syntax were now flawless. All pretense of naivete, of an alien quality, had been dropped, but Norman felt stronger, more confident, as the conversation progressed. He knew whom he was talking to now. He wasn't talking to any alien. There weren't any unknown assumptions. He was talking to a childish part of another human being.
I have more power than you can imagine.
I know you have power, Jerry, Norman said. Big deal.
Harry became suddenly agitated. Norman, for Christ's sake, you're going to get us all killed.
Listen to Harry. He is wise. No, Jerry, Norman said. Harry is not wise. He is only afraid.
Harry is not afraid. Absolutely not.
Norman decided to let that pass. I'm talking to you, Jerry. Only to you. You are the one who is playing games.
Games are stupid.
Yes, they are, Jerry. They are not worthy of you.
Games are not of interest to any intelligent person.
Then stop, Jerry. Stop the manifestations.
I can stop whenever I want.
I am not sure you can, Jerry.
Yes, I can.
Then prove it. Stop this sport of manifestations.
There was a long pause. They waited for the response.
Norman, your tricks of manipulation are childish and obvious to the point of tedium. I am not interested in talking with you further. I will do exactly as I please, and I will manifest as I wish. Our habitat cannot withstand more manifestations, Jerry.
I do not care.
If you injure our habitat again, Harry will die.
Harry said, Me and everybody else, for Christ's sake. I do not care, Norman.
Why would you kill us, Jerry?
You should not be down here in the first place. You people do not belong here. You are arrogant creatures who intrude everywhere in the world
and you have taken a great foolish risk, and now you must pay the price. You are an uncaring, unfeeling species with no love for one another."
"That's not true, Jerry."
"Do not contradict me again, Norman.
I'm sorry, but the unfeeling, uncaring person is you, Jerry. You do not care if you injure us. You do not care for our predicament. It is you who are uncaring, Jerry, not us. You."
"Enough."
"He's not going to talk to you anymore," Harry said. "He's really mad, Norman."
And then the screen printed, "I will kill you all."
Norman was sweating. He wiped his forehead, turned away from the words on the screen.
"I don't think you can talk to this guy," Beth said.
"I don't think you can reason with him."
"You shouldn't have made him angry," Harry said. He was almost pleading. "Why did you make him angry like that, Norman?"
"I had to tell him the truth."
"But you were so mean to him, and now he's angry."
"It doesn't matter, angry or not," Beth said. "Harry attacked us before when he wasn't angry."
"You mean Jerry," Norman said to her. "Jerry attacked us."
"Yes, right, Jerry."
"That's a hell of a mistake to make, Beth," Harry said.
"You're right, Harry. I'm sorry."
Harry was looking at her in an odd way. Norman thought, Harry doesn't miss a trick, and he isn't going to let that one go by.
"I don't know how you could make that confusion," Harry said.
"I know, it was a slip of the tongue. It was stupid of him."
"I'll say."
"I'm sorry," Beth said. "Really, I am."
"Never mind," Harry said. "It doesn't matter." There was a sudden flatness in his manner, a complete indifference in his tone. Norman thought, uh-oh. Harry yawned and stretched.
"You know," he said, "I'm suddenly very tired. I think I'll take a nap now."
And he went off to the bunks. 1600 hours.
"We have to do something," Beth said. "We can't talk him out of it."
"You're right," Norman said. "We can't." Beth tapped the screen. The words still glowed. "I will kill you all."
"Do you think he means it?"
"Yes." Beth stood, clenched her fists.
"So it's him or us?"
"Yes, I think so." The implications hung in the air, unspoken.
"This manifesting process of his," Beth said, "you think he has to be completely unconscious to prevent it from happening?"
"Yes." "Or dead," Beth said. "Yes," Norman said. That had occurred to him. It seemed so improbable, such an unlikely turn of events in his life, that he would now be 1,000 feet under the water, contemplating the murder of another human being. Yet that was what he was doing.
"I'd hate to kill him," Beth said.
"Me too."
"I mean, I wouldn't even know how to begin to do it."
"Maybe we don't have to kill him," Norman said.
"Maybe we don't have to kill him unless he starts something," Beth said. Then she shook her head. "Oh, hell, Norman, who are we kidding? This habitat can't survive another attack. We've got to kill him. I just don't want to face up to it."
"Neither do I," Norman said.
"We could get one of those explosive spear guns and have an unfortunate accident, and then just wait for our time to be up for the Navy to come and get us out of here."
"I don't want to do that."
"I don't either," Beth said.
"But what else can we do?"
"We don't have to kill him," Norman said. "Just make him unconscious."
He went to the first aid cabinet, started going through the medicines.
"You think there might be something there?" Beth said.
"Maybe. An anesthetic? I don't know."
"Would that work?"
"I think anything that produces unconsciousness will work. I think."
"I hope you're right," Beth said.
"Because if he starts dreaming and then manifests the monsters from his dreams, that wouldn't be very good."
"No, but anesthesia produces a dreamless, total state of unconsciousness." Norman was looking at the labels on the bottles.
"Do you know what these things are?" No, Beth said, but it's all on the computer.
She sat down at the console.
Read me the names, and I'll look them up for you.
Diphenylparaline. Beth pushed buttons, scanned a screen of dense text.
Looks like something for burns.
Ephedrine hydrochloride. Another screen.
I guess it's for motion sickness.
Valdomet.
It's for ulcers.
Syntag. Synthetic opium analog. It's very short-acting.
Produces unconsciousness? Norman asked.
No, not according to this. Anyway, it only lasts a few minutes.
Tarazine.
Tranquilizer. Causes drowsiness.
Good. He set the bottle to one side.
And may also cause bizarre ideation.
No, he said, and put the bottle back. They didn't need to have any bizarre ideation.
Riordan?
Antihistamine, for bites.
Oxalamine?
Antibiotic.
Chloramphenicol?
Another antibiotic.
Damn, they were running out of bottles.
Paracelsotrine?
It's a soporific.
What's that?
Causes sleep.
You mean it's a sleeping pill?
No, it says you can give it in combination with paracin trichloride and use it as an anesthetic.
Paracin trichloride?
Yes, I have it here, Norman said.
Beth was reading from the screen.
Paracelsotrine 20 cc's in combination with paracin 6 cc's given IM produces deep sleep suitable for emergency surgical procedures. No cardiac side effects. Sleep from which the subject can be awakened only with difficulty. REM activity is suppressed.
How long does it last?
3 to 6 hours.
And how fast does it take effect?
She frowned.
It doesn't say. After appropriate depth of anesthesia is induced, even extensive surgical procedures may be begun. But it doesn't say how long it takes.
Hell, Norman said.
It's probably fast,
Beth said.
But what if it isn't, Norman said. What if it takes 20 minutes? And can you fight it off?
She shook her head.
Nothing about that here.
In the end, they decided on a mixture of paracelsotrine, paracin, dulcinea, and Syntag, the opiate. Norman filled a large syringe with the clear liquids. The syringe was so big it looked like something for horses.
You think it might kill him?
Beth said.
I don't know. Do we have a choice?
No, Beth said. We've got to do it. Have you ever given an injection before?
Norman shook his head.
You?
Only lab animals.
Where do I stick it?
Do it in the shoulder, Beth said, while he's asleep.
Norman turned the syringe up to the light and squirted a few drops from the needle into the air.
Okay, he said.
I better come with you, Beth said, and hold him down.
No, Norman said. If he's awake and sees both of us coming, he'll be suspicious. Remember, you don't sleep in the bunks anymore.
But what if he gets violent?
I think I can handle this.
Okay, Norman, whatever you say.
The lights in the corridor of C-Sill seemed unnaturally bright. Norman heard his feet padding on the carpet, heard the constant hum of the air handlers and the space heaters. He felt the weight of the syringe concealed in his palm. He came to the door to the sleeping quarters. 2 female Navy crewmen were standing outside the bulkhead door. They snapped to attention as he approached.
Dr. Johnson, sir.
Norman paused. The women were handsome, black, and muscular-looking.
At ease, men, Norman said with a smile.
They did not relax.
Sorry, sir. We have our orders, sir.
I see, Norman said. Well, carry on, then.
He started to move past them into the sleeping area.
Beg your pardon, Dr. Johnson, sir.
They barred his way.
What is it? Norman asked, as innocently as he could manage.
This area is off limits to all personnel, sir.
But I want to go to sleep.
Very sorry, Dr. Johnson, sir,
No one may disturb Dr. Adams while he sleeps, sir.
I won't disturb Dr. Adams.
Sorry, Dr. Johnson, sir. May we see what is in your hand, sir?
In my hand?
Yes, there is something in your hand, sir.
Their snapping machine gun delivery, always punctuated by the sir at the end, was getting on his nerves. He looked at them again. The starched uniforms covered powerful muscles. He didn't think he could force his way past them. Beyond the door, he saw Harry lying on his back, snoring. It was a perfect moment to inject him.
Dr. Johnson, may we see what is in your hand, sir?
No, damn it, you may not.
Very good, sir.
Norman turned and walked back to D-Sill. I saw, Beth said, nodding to the monitor. Norman looked at the monitor, at the two women in the corridor. Then he looked at the adjacent monitor, which showed the sphere.
The sphere has changed, Norman said.
The convoluted grooves of the doorway were definitely altered, the pattern more complex and shifted farther up. Norman felt sure it was changed.
I think you're right, Beth said.
When did that happen?
We can run the tapes back later, she said. Right now we'd better take care of those two.
How? Norman said.
Simple, Beth said, bunching her fists again. We have 5 explosive spearheads in B-Sill. I'll go into B, get 2 of them, blow the guardian angels away. You run in and jab Harry.
Her cold-blooded determination would have been chilling if she didn't look so beautiful. There was a refined quality to her features now. She seemed to grow more elegant by the minute.
The spear guns are in B, Norman said.
Sure, look on video. She pressed a button.
Hell.
In B-Sill, the spear guns were missing. I think the son of a bitch has covered his bases, Norman said. Good old Harry. Beth looked at him thoughtfully. Norman, are you feeling okay?
Sure, why?
There's a mirror in the first aid kit. Go look. He opened the white box of the kit and looked at himself in the mirror. He was shocked by what he saw. Not that he expected to look good. He was accustomed to the pudgy contours of his own face and the gray stubble of his beard when he didn't shave on weekends. But the face, staring back at him, was lean, with a coarse jet-black beard. There were dark circles beneath smoldering, bloodshot eyes. His hair was lank and greasy, hanging over his forehead. He looked like a dangerous man.
I look like Dr. Jekyll, he said.
Or rather, Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, you do.
You're getting more beautiful, he said to Beth. But I'm the man who was mean to Jerry, so I'm getting meaner.
You think Harry's doing this?
I think so, Norman said, adding to himself, I hope so.
You feel different, Norman?
No, I feel exactly the same. I just look like hell.
Yes, you look a little frightening.
I'm sure I do.
You really feel fine?
Beth.
Okay,
Beth said. She turned, looked back at the monitors. I have one last idea. We both get to A-Cell, put on our suits, get into B-Cell, and shut down the oxygen in the rest of the habitat. Make Harry unconscious. His guards will disappear. We can go in and jab him.
What do you think?
Worth a try. Norman put down the syringe. They headed off toward A-Sill. In C-Sill, they passed the 2 guards, who again snapped to attention.
Dr. Halpern, sir. Dr. Johnson, sir.
Carry on, men, Beth said.
Yes, sir.
May we ask where you were going, sir?
Routine inspection tour, Beth said.
There was a pause.
Very good, sir.
They were allowed to pass. They moved into B-Sill with its array of pipes and machinery. Norman glanced at it nervously. He didn't like screwing around with the life support systems, but he didn't see what else they could do. In A-Sill, there were 3 suits left. Norman reached for his.
You know what you're doing? He asked.
Yes,
Beth said.
Trust me.
She slipped her foot into her suit and started zipping it up. And then the alarms began to sound throughout the habitat, and the red lights flashed again.
Norman knew, without being told, that it was the peripheral alarms. Another attack was beginning. 15:20 hours. They ran back through the lateral connecting corridor directly from B-sill into D. Norman noticed in passing that the crewman had gone. In D, the alarms were clanging and the peripheral sensor screens glowed bright red. Norman glanced at the video monitors.
I am coming. Beth quickly scanned the screens.
Inner thermals are activated. He's coming, all right. They felt a thump, and Norman turned to look out the porthole. The green squid was already outside, the huge suckered arms coiling around the base of the habitat. One great arm slapped flat against the porthole, the suckers distorted against the glass.
I am here.
Harry! Beth shouted. There was a tentative jolt as squid arms gripped the habitat, the slow, agonizing creak of metal. Harry came running into the room.
What is it?
You know what it is, Harry, Beth shouted.
No, no, what is it?
It's the squid, Harry.
Oh, my God, no,
Harry moaned. The habitat shook powerfully. The room lights flickered and went out. There was only flashing red now from the emergency lights. Norman turned to him.
Stop it, Harry.
What are you talking about? He cried plaintively.
You know what I'm talking about, Harry.
I don't.
Yes, you do, Harry. It's you, Harry, Norman said. You're doing it.
No, you're wrong. It's not me. I swear it's not me.
Yes, Harry, Norman said. And if you don't stop it, we'll all die. The habitat shook again. One of the ceiling heaters exploded, showering fragments of hot glass and wire. Come on, Harry.
No, no.
There's not much time. You know you're doing it.
The habitat can't take much more, Norman, Beth said. It can't be me.
Yes, Harry. Face it, Harry. Face it now.
Even as he spoke, Norman was looking for the syringe. He had left it somewhere in this room, but papers were sliding off the desktops, monitors crashing to the floor, chaos all around him. The whole habitat rocked again, and there was a tremendous explosion from another cylinder. New rising alarms sounded, and a roaring vibration that Norman instantly recognized. Water, under great pressure, rushing into the habitat.
Flooding in sea, Beth shouted, reading the consoles.
She ran down the corridor. He heard the metal clang of bulkhead doors as she shut them. The room was filled with salty mist. Norman pushed Harry against the wall.
Harry, face it and stop it.
It can't be me, it can't be me, Harry moaned. Another jolting impact staggering them.
It can't be me, Harry cried. It has nothing to do with me.
And then Harry screamed, and his body twisted, and Norman saw Beth withdraw the syringe from his shoulder, the needle tipped with blood.
What are you doing?
Harry cried, but already his eyes were glassy and vacant. He staggered at the next impact, fell drunkenly on his knees to the floor.
No,
he said softly.
No.
And he collapsed, falling face down on the carpet. Immediately, the wrenching of metal stopped. The alarms stopped. Everything became ominously silent, except for the soft gurgle of water from somewhere within the habitat. Beth moved swiftly, reading one screen after another. Inner off, peripherals off, everything off.
All right, no readings.
Norman ran to the porthole. The squid had disappeared. The sea bottom outside was deserted.
Damage report, Beth shouted. Main power out. E cylinder out. C cylinder out. B cylinder.
Norman spun, looked at her. If B cylinder was gone, their life support would be gone. They would certainly die.
B cylinder holding, she said finally.
Her body sagged. We're okay, Norman. Norman collapsed on the carpet, exhausted, suddenly feeling the strain and tension in every part of his body. It was over.
The crisis had passed.
They were going to be all right after all. Norman felt his body relax. It was over. 12:30 hours. The blood had stopped flowing from Harry's broken nose, and now he seemed to be breathing more regularly, more easily. Norman lifted the ice pack to look at the swollen face and adjusted the flow of the intravenous drip in Harry's arm. Beth had started the intravenous line in Harry's hand after several unsuccessful attempts. They were dripping an anesthetic mixture into him. Harry's breath smelled sour, like tin, but otherwise he was okay, out cold. The radio crackled. "I'm at the submarine," Beth said. "Going aboard now." Norman glanced out the porthole at DH-7, saw Beth climbing up into the dome beside the sub. She was going to press the delay button, the last time such a trip would be necessary. He turned back to Harry. The computer didn't have any information about the effects of keeping a person asleep for 12 hours straight, but that was what they would have to do. Either Harry would make it or he wouldn't. Same as the rest of us, Norman thought. He glanced at the monitor clocks. They showed 12:30 hours and counted backward. He put a blanket over Harry and went over to the console. The sphere was still there, with its changed pattern of grooves. In all the excitement, he had almost forgotten his initial fascination with the sphere, where it had come from, what it meant. Although they understood now what it meant. What had Beth called it? A mental enzyme. An enzyme was something that made chemical reactions possible without actually participating in them. Our bodies needed to perform chemical reactions, but our body temperatures were too cold for most chemical reactions to proceed smoothly. So we had enzymes to help the process along, speed it up. The enzymes made it all possible, and she had called the sphere a mental enzyme. Very clever, he thought. Clever woman. Her impulsiveness had turned out to be just what was needed. With Harry unconscious, Beth still looked beautiful. But Norman was relieved to find that his own features had returned to pudgy normalcy. He saw his own familiar reflection in the screen as he stared at the sphere on the monitor. That sphere. With Harry unconscious, he wondered if they would ever know exactly what had happened. Exactly what it had been like. He remembered the lights like fireflies. And what had Harry said? Something about foam. The foam. Norman heard a whirring sound and looked out the porthole. The sub was moving. Freed of its tethers, the yellow minisub glided across the bottom, its lights shining on the ocean floor. Norman pushed the intercom button. Beth? Beth!
I'm here, Norman.
What are you doing?
Just take it easy, Norman.
What are you doing in the sub, Beth?
Just a precaution, Norman.
Are you leaving?
She laughed over the intercom, a light, relaxed laugh. No, Norman, just take it easy.
Tell me what you're doing.
It's a secret.
Come on, Beth. This was all he needed, he thought, to have Beth crack up now. He thought again of her impulsiveness, which moments before he had admired. He did not admire it anymore. Beth?
Talk to you later, she said.
The sub turned in profile, and he saw red boxes in its claw arms. He could not read the lettering on the boxes, but they looked vaguely familiar. As he watched, the sub moved past the high fin of the spacecraft and then settled to the bottom. One of the boxes was released, plumping softly on the muddy floor. The sub started up again, churning sediment, and glided forward 100 yards. Then it stopped again and released another box. It continued this way along the length of the spacecraft. Beth?
No answer.
Norman squinted at the boxes. There was lettering on them, but he could not read them at this distance. The sub had turned now and was coming directly toward DH-8. The lights shone at him. It moved closer, and the sensor alarms went off, clanging and flashing red lights. He hated these alarms, he thought, going over to the console, looking at the buttons. How the hell did you turn them off? He glanced at Harry, but Harry remained unconscious. Beth, are you there? You set off the damn alarms.
Push F8.
What the hell was F8? He looked around, finally saw a row of keys on the keyboard, numbered F1 to F20. He pushed F8, and the alarms stopped. The sub was now very close, lights shining into the porthole windows. In the high bubble, Beth was clearly visible, instrument lights shining up on her face. Then the sub descended out of view. He went to the porthole and looked out. Deep Star 3 was resting on the bottom, depositing more boxes from its claw hands. Now he could read the lettering on the boxes. Caution. No smoking. No electronics. TVAC explosives.
Beth, what the hell are you doing?
Later, Norman.
He listened to her voice. She sounded okay.
Was she cracking up?
No, he thought. She's not cracking up. She sounds okay. I'm sure she's okay. But he wasn't sure. The sub was moving again, its lights blurred by the cloud of sediment churned up by the propellers. The cloud drifted up past the porthole, obscuring his vision.
Beth?
Everything's fine, Norman. Back in a minute.
As the sediment drifted down to the bottom again, he saw the sub heading back to DH-7. Moments later, it docked beneath the dome. Then he saw Beth climb out and tether the sub fore and aft. 1100 hours.
It's very simple, Beth said.
Explosives? He pointed to the screen. It says here TVACs are, weight for weight, the most powerful conventional explosives known. What the hell are you doing putting them around the habitat?
Norman, take it easy. She rested her hand on his shoulder. Her touch was soft and reassuring. He relaxed a little, feeling her body so close.
We should have discussed this together first.
Norman, I'm not taking any chances, not anymore.
But Harry is unconscious.
He might wake up.
He won't, Beth. I'm not taking any chances, she said. This way, if something starts to come out of that sphere, we can blow the hell out of the whole ship. I've put explosives along the whole length of it.
But why around the habitat?
Defense.
How is it defense?
Believe me, it is.
Beth, it's dangerous to have that stuff so close to us.
It's not wired up, Norman. In fact, it's not wired up around the ship, either. I have to go out and do that by hand.
She glanced at the screens.
I thought I'd wait a while first, maybe take a nap. Are you tired?
No, Norman said.
You haven't slept in a long time, Norman.
I'm not tired. She gave him an appraising look.
I'll keep an eye on Harry, if that's what you're worried about.
I'm just not tired, Beth.
Okay, she said. Suit yourself.
She brushed her luxuriant hair back from her face with her fingers.
Personally, I'm exhausted.
I'm going to get a few hours.
She started up the stairs to her lab, then looked down at him.
Want to join me?
What?
He said.
She smiled at him, directly, knowingly.
You heard me, Norman.
Maybe later, Beth.
Okay, sure.
She ascended the staircase, her body swinging smoothly, sensuously in the tight jumpsuit. She looked good in that jumpsuit. He had to admit it, she was a good-looking woman. Across the room, Harry snored in a regular rhythm. Norman checked Harry's ice pack and thought about Beth. He heard her moving around in the lab upstairs.
Hey, Norm?
Yes? He moved to the bottom of the stairs, looked up.
Is there another one of these down there? A clean one?
Something blue dropped into his hands. It was her jumpsuit.
Yes, I think they're in storage in B.
Bring me one, would you, Norm?
Okay, he said. Going to B still, he found himself inexplicably nervous.
What was going on?
Of course, he thought, he knew exactly what was going on. But why now? Beth was exerting a powerful attraction, and he mistrusted it. In her dealings with men, Beth was confrontational, energetic, direct, and angry. Seduction wasn't her method at all. It is now, he thought, fishing a new jumpsuit out of the storage locker. He took it back to D-Sill and climbed the ladder. From above, he saw a strange, bluish light.
Beth?
I'm here, Norm.
He came up and saw her lying naked on her back, beneath a bank of ultraviolet sun lamps hinged out from the wall. She wore opaque cups over her eyes. She twisted her body seductively.
Did you bring the suit?
Yes, he said.
Thanks a lot. Just
Put it anywhere, by the lab bench.
Okay. He draped it over her chair. She rolled back to face the glowing lamps, sighed.
I thought I'd better get a little vitamin D, Norm.
Yes. You probably should, too.
Yeah, probably.
But Norman was thinking that he didn't remember a bank of sun lamps in the lab. In fact, he was sure that there wasn't one. He had spent a lot of time in that room. He would have remembered. He went back down the stairs quickly. In fact, the staircase was new, too. It was black anodized metal. It hadn't been that way before. This was a new descending staircase.
Norm?
In a minute, Beth. He went to the console and started punching buttons. He had seen a file before on habitat parameters or something like that. He finally found it. Deep Hab 8, MIPPR, design parameters. 5.024A, cylinder A. 5.024B, cylinder B. 5.024C, cylinder C. 5.024D, cylinder D. 5.024E, cylinder E. Choose one. He chose Sil D, and another screen appeared. He chose design plans. He got page after page of architectural drawings. He flicked through them, stabbing at the keys, until he came to the detail plans for the biological laboratory at the top of D-Sil. Clearly shown in the drawings was a large sun lamp bank, hinged to fold back against the wall. It must have been there all the time. He just hadn't ever noticed it. There were lots of other details he hadn't noticed, like the emergency escape hatch in the domed ceiling of the lab, and the fact that there was a second fold-out bunk near the floor entrance, and a black anodized descending staircase. You're in a panic, he thought, and it has nothing to do with sun lamps and architectural drawings. It doesn't even have to do with sex. You're in a panic because Beth is the only one left besides you. And Beth isn't acting like herself. In the corner of the screen, he watched the small clock tick backward, the seconds clicking off with agonizing slowness. 12 more hours, he thought. I've just got to last 12 more hours and everything will be all right. He was hungry, but he knew there wasn't any food. He was tired, but there wasn't any place for him to sleep. Both E and C cylinders were flooded. And he didn't want to go upstairs with Beth. Norman lay down on the floor of D-Sill, beside Harry on the couch. It was cold and damp on the floor. For a long time, he couldn't sleep. 0900 hours. The pounding, that terrifying pounding, and the shaking of the floor awakened him abruptly. He rolled over and got to his feet, instantly alert. He saw Beth standing by the monitors. "What is it?" he cried. "What is it?"
"What is what?" Beth said.
She seemed calm. She smiled at him. Norman looked around. The alarms hadn't gone off. The lights weren't flashing.
"I don't know," I thought. "I don't know."
He trailed off.
"You thought we were under attack again?"
she said.
He nodded.
"Why would you think that, Norman?" she said. Beth was looking at him again in that odd way, an appraising way, her stare very direct and cool. There was no hint of seductiveness to her. If anything, she conveyed the suspiciousness of the old Beth. "You're a man, and you're a problem."
"Harry's still unconscious, isn't he? So why would you think we were being attacked?"
"I don't know. I guess I was dreaming." Beth shrugged.
"Maybe you felt the vibration of me walking on the floor," she said. "Anyway, I'm glad you decided to sleep."
That same appraising stare, as if there were something wrong with him.
"You haven't slept enough, Norman."
"None of us have."
"You particularly."
"Maybe you're right." He had to admit he felt better now that he had slept for a couple of hours. He smiled. "Did you eat all the coffee in Danish?"
"There isn't any coffee in Danish, Norman."
"I know."
"Then why would you say that?"
she asked seriously. "It was a joke, Beth."
"Oh, just a joke. You know, a humorous reflection on our condition."
"I see." She was working with the screens.
By the way, what did you find out about the balloon?
The balloon?
The surface balloon. Remember we talked about it?
He shook his head. He didn't remember.
Before I went out to the sub, I asked about the control codes to send a balloon to the surface, and you said you'd look in the computer and see if you could find how to do it.
I did?
Yes, Norman, you did.
He thought back. He remembered how he and Beth had lifted Harry's inert, surprisingly heavy body off the floor, setting him on the couch, and how they had staunched the flow of blood from his nose while Beth had started an intravenous line, which she knew how to do from her work with lab animals. In fact, she had made a joke, saying she hoped Harry fared better than her lab animals, since they usually ended up dead. Then Beth had volunteered to go to the sub, and he had said he'd stay with Harry. That was what he remembered, nothing about any balloons.
Sure, Beth said. Because the communication said we were supposed to acknowledge transmission, and that means a radio balloon sent to the surface. And we figured with the storm abating, the surface conditions must be calm enough to allow the balloon to ride without snapping the wire. So it was a question of how to release the balloons, and you said you'd look for the control commands.
I really don't remember, he said. I'm sorry.
Norman, we have to work together in these last few hours, Beth said.
I agree, Beth, absolutely.
How are you feeling now? She said.
Okay. Pretty good, in fact.
Good, she said. Hang in there, Norman. It's only a few more hours.
She hugged him warmly. But when she released him, he saw in her eyes that same detached, appraising look. An hour later, they figured out how to release the balloon. They distantly heard a metallic sizzle as the wire unwound from the outside spool, trailing behind the inflated balloon as it shot toward the surface. Then there was a long pause.
What's happening? Norman said.
We're 1,000 feet down, Beth said. It takes a while for the balloon to get to the surface. Then the screen changed, and they got a readout of surface conditions. Wind was down to 15 knots. Waves were running 6 feet. Barometric pressure was 20.9. Sunlight was recorded.
Good news, Beth said. The surface is okay.
Norman was staring at the screen, thinking about the fact that sunlight was recorded. He had never longed for sunlight before. It was funny what you took for granted. Now the thought of seeing sunlight struck him as unbelievably pleasurable. He could imagine no greater joy than to see sun and clouds and blue sky.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking I can't wait to get out of here.
Me too, Beth said. But it won't be long now.
Pong, 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 pong. Norman was checking Harry, and he spun at the sound.
What is it, Beth?
Pong, 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 pong.
Take it easy, Beth said at the console. I'm just figuring out how to work this thing.
Pong, 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 pong.
Work what? The side-scanning sonar. False aperture sonar. I don't know why they call it false aperture. You know what that refers to, false aperture?
Pong, 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 pong.
No, I don't, Norman said. Turn it off, please.
The sound was unnerving.
It's marked FAS, which I think stands for false aperture sonar, but it also says side scanning. It's very confusing.
Beth, turn it off.
Pong, 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 pong.
Sure, of course, Beth said.
Why do you want to know how to work that anyway? Norman said. He felt irritable, as if she'd intentionally annoyed him with that sound.
Just in case, Beth said.
In case what, for Christ's sake? You said yourself that Harry's unconscious. There aren't going to be any more attacks.
Take it easy, Norman, Beth said. I want to be prepared, that's all.
0720 hours. He couldn't talk her out of it. She insisted on going outside and wiring the explosives around the ship. It was an absolutely fixed idea in her mind.
But why, Beth? He kept saying.
Because I'll feel better after I do it, she said.
But there isn't any reason to do it.
I'll feel better if I do, she insisted, and in the end he couldn't stop her.
He saw her now, a small figure with a single glowing light from her helmet, moving from one crate of explosives to another. She opened each crate and removed large yellow cones, which looked rather like the cones that highway repair trucks used. These cones were wired together, and when the wiring was completed, a small red light glowed at the tip. He saw small red lights all up and down the length of the ship. It made him uneasy. When she left, he had said to her, "But you won't wire up the explosives near the habitat."
"No, Norman, I won't."
"Promise me."
"I told you I won't. If it's going to upset you, I won't."
"It's going to upset me."
"Okay, okay."
Now the red lights were strung along the length of the ship, starting at the dimly visible tail, which rose out of the coral bottom. Beth moved farther north toward the rest of the unopened crates. Norman looked at Harry, who snored loudly but who remained unconscious. He paced back and forth in D-Sill and then went to the monitors. The screen blinked.
"I am coming."
"Oh, God," he thought. And in the next moment he thought, "How can this be happening? It can't be happening. Harry was still out cold. How could it be happening?"
"I am coming for you."
"Beth!" Her voice sounded tinny on the intercom.
"Yes, Norman?"
"Get the hell out of there."
"Do not be afraid," the screen said.
"What is it, Norman?" she said.
"I'm getting something on the screen."
"Check Harry. He must be waking up."
"He's not. Get back here, Beth."
"I am coming now."
"All right, Norman. I'm heading back," she said. "Fast, Beth." But he didn't need to say that. Already he could see her light bouncing as she ran across the bottom. She was at least 100 yards from the habitat. He heard her breathing hard on the intercom.
"Can you see anything, Norman?"
"No, nothing." He was straining to look toward the horizon, where the squid had always appeared. The first thing had always been a green glow on the horizon, but he saw no glow now. Beth was panting.
"I can feel something, Norman. I feel the water. Surging. Strong."
The screen flashed. "I will kill you."
"Don't you see anything out here?"
Beth said. "No, I don't see anything at all." He saw Beth alone on the muddy bottom, her light the solitary focus of his attention.
"I can feel it, Norman. It's close. Jesus, God. What about the alarms?"
"Nothing, Beth."
"Jesus."
Her breath came in hissing gasps as she ran. Beth was in good shape, but she couldn't exert herself like that in this atmosphere. Not for long, he thought. Already he could see she was moving more slowly, the helmet lamp bobbing more slowly.
"Norman?"
"Yes, Beth, I'm here."
"Norman, I don't know if I can make it."
"Beth, you can make it. Slow down."
"It's here. I can feel it."
"I don't see anything, Beth." He heard a rapid, sharp clicking sound. At first he thought it was static on the line, and then he realized it was her teeth chattering as she shivered. With this exertion, she should be getting overheated. But instead, she was getting cold. He didn't understand.
"Cold, Norman?"
"Slow down, Beth."
"Can't. Talking. Close."
She was slowing down despite herself. She had come into the area of the habitat lights, and she was no more than 10 yards from the hatch, but he could see her limbs moving slowly, clumsily. And now, at last, he could see something swirling the muddy sediment behind her, in the darkness beyond the lights. It was like a tornado, a swirling cloud of muddy sediment. He couldn't see what was inside the cloud, but he sensed the power within it.
"Close. Nor."
Beth stumbled, fell. The swirling cloud moved toward her.
"I will kill you now."
Beth got to her feet, looked back, saw the churning cloud bearing down on her. Something about it filled Norman with a deep horror, a horror from childhood, the stuff of nightmares.
"Norman!"
Then Norman was running, not really knowing what he was going to do, but propelled by the vision he had seen, thinking only that he had to do something. He had to take some action.
and he went through B into A and looked at his suit. But there wasn't time, and the black water in the open hatch was spitting and swirling, and he saw Beth's gloved hand below the surface, flailing. She was right there beneath him, and she was the only other one. And without thinking, he jumped into the black water and went down. The shock of the cold made him want to scream. It tore at his lungs. His whole body was instantly numb, and he felt a second of hideous paralysis. The water churned and tossed him like a great wave. He was powerless to fight it. His head banged on the underside of the habitat. He could see nothing at all. He reached for Beth, throwing his arms blindly in all directions. His lungs burned. The water spun him in circles, upended him. He touched her, lost her. The water continued to spin him. He grabbed her something, an arm. He was already losing feeling, already feeling slower and stupider. He pulled. He saw a ring of light above him, the hatch. He kicked his legs, but he did not seem to move. The circle came no closer. He kicked again, dragging Beth like a dead weight. Perhaps she was dead. His lungs burned. It was the worst pain he had ever felt in his life. He fought the pain, and he fought the angry, churning water, and he kept kicking toward the light. That was his only thought, to kick to the light, to come closer to the light, to reach the light, the light, the light, the light. The images were confusing. Beth's suited body clanging on the metal inside the airlock, his own knee bleeding on the metal of the hatch, the drops of blood spattering. Beth's shaking hands, reaching for her helmet, twisting it, trying to get the helmet unlocked. Hands shaking. Water in the hatch, sucking, surging. Lights in his eyes. A terrible pain somewhere. Rust very close to his face. A sharp edge of metal. Cold metal. Cold air. Lights in his eyes dimming. Fading. Blackness. The sensation of warmth was pleasant. He heard a hissing roar in his ears. He looked up and saw Beth, out of her suit, looming large above him, adjusting the big space heater, turning the power up. She was still shivering, but she was turning up the heat. He closed his eyes. "We made it," he thought. "We're still together. We're still okay. We made it." He relaxed. There was a crawly sensation over his body. From the cold, he thought. His body warming from the cold. The crawly sensation was not pleasant. And the hissing was not pleasant either. It was sibilant, intermittent. Something slithered softly under his chin as he lay on the deck. He opened his eyes and saw a silvery white tube. And then he focused and saw the tiny beady eyes and the flicking tongue. It was a snake. A sea snake. He froze. He looked down, moving only his eyes. His entire body was covered with white snakes. The crawly sensation came from dozens of snakes, coiling around his ankles, sliding between his legs, over his chest. He felt a cool, slithering motion across his forehead. He closed his eyes, feeling horror as the snake body moved over his face, down his nose, brushed over his lips, then moved away. He listened to the hissing of the reptiles and thought of how poisonous Beth had said they were. Beth, he thought, where is Beth? He did not move. He felt snakes coiling around his neck, slipping over his shoulder, sliding between the fingers of his hands. He did not want to open his eyes. He felt a surge of nausea. God, he thought, I'm going to throw up. He felt snakes under his armpit and felt snakes slipping past his groin. He burst into a cold sweat. He fought nausea. Beth, he thought. He did not want to speak. Beth. He listened to the hissing, and then, when he couldn't stand it anymore, he opened his eyes and saw the mass of coiling, writhing white flesh, the tiny heads, the flickering forked tongues. He closed his eyes again. He felt one crawling up the leg of his jumpsuit, moving against his bare skin. Don't move, Norman. It was Beth. He could hear the tension in her voice. He looked up, could not see her, only her shadow. He heard her say, Oh God, what time is it? And he thought, the hell with the time. Who cares what time it is? It didn't make any sense to him. I have to know the time, Beth was saying. He heard her feet moving on the deck.
The time...
She was moving away, leaving him. The snakes slid over his ears, under his chin, past his nostrils. The bodies damp and slithering. Then he heard her feet on the deck and a metallic clang as she threw open the hatch. He opened his eyes to see her bending over him, grabbing the snakes in great handfuls, throwing them down the hatch into the water. Snakes writhed in her hands, twisted around her wrists, but she shook them off, tossed them aside. Some of the snakes didn't land in the water and coiled on the deck, but most of the snakes were off his body now. One more, crawling up his leg toward his groin. He felt it moving quickly backward. She was pulling it out by the tail.
Jesus, careful!
The snake was out, flung over her shoulder.
You can get up, Norman, she said.
He jumped to his feet and promptly vomited. 0700 hours. He had a murderous, pounding headache. It made the habitat lights seem unpleasantly bright. And he was cold. Beth had wrapped him in blankets and had moved him next to the big space heaters in D-Sill, so close that the hum of the electrical elements was very loud in his ears, but he was still cold. He looked down at her now as she bandaged his cut knee.
How is it? He said.
Not good, she said. It's right down to the bone. But you'll be all right. It's only a few more hours now.
Yes, I...
Ouch!
Sorry, almost done. Beth was following first aid directions from the computer. To distract his mind from the pain, he read the screen. Minor medical, non-lethal complications. 7.113, trauma. 7.115, microsleep. 7.118, helium tremor. 7.119, otitis. 7.121, toxic contaminants. 7.143, synovial pain. Choose one.
That's what I need, he said. Some micro sleep. Or better yet, some serious macro sleep.
Yes, we all do.
A thought occurred to him. Beth, remember when you were pulling the snakes off me? What was all that you were saying about the time of day?
Sea snakes are diurnal, Beth said. Many poisonous snakes are alternately aggressive and passive in 12-hour cycles, corresponding to day and night. During the day, when they're passive, you can handle them and they will never bite. For example, in India, the highly poisonous banded krait has never been known to bite during the day, even when children play with them. But at night, watch out. So I was trying to determine which cycle the sea snakes were on, until I decided that this must be their passive daytime cycle.
How do you figure that?
Because you were still alive.
Then she had used her bare hands to remove the snakes, knowing that they wouldn't bite her either. With your hands full of snakes, you looked like Medusa.
What is that, a rock star?
No, it's a mythological figure.
The one who killed her children? She asked with a quick, suspicious glance, Beth ever alert to a veiled insult.
No, that's somebody else. That was Medea. Medusa was a mythical woman with a head full of snakes who turned men to stone if they looked at her. Perseus killed her by looking at her reflection in his polished shield.
Sorry, Norman, not my field.
It was remarkable, he thought. But at one time, every educated Western person knew these figures from mythology and the stories behind them intimately. As intimately as they knew the stories of families and friends. Myths had once represented the common knowledge of humanity, and they served as a kind of map of consciousness. But now a well-educated person, such as Beth, knew nothing of myths at all. It was as if men had decided that the map of human consciousness had changed. But had it really changed? He shivered.
Still cold, Norman?
Yeah, but the worst thing is the headache.
You're probably dehydrated. Let's see if I can find something for you to drink.
She went to the first aid box on the wall.
You know, that was a hell of a thing you did, Beth said. Jumping in like that without a suit. That water's only a couple of degrees above freezing.
It was very brave. Stupid, but brave. She smiled.
You saved my life, Norman.
I didn't think, Norman said. I just did it. And then he told her how, when he had seen her outside, with the churning cloud of sediment approaching her, he had felt an old and childish horror.
something from distant memory.
You know what it was?
He said.
It reminded me of the tornado in The Wizard of Oz. That tornado scared the bejesus out of me when I was a kid. I just didn't want to see it happen again.
And then he thought, perhaps these are our new myths. Dorothy and Toto and the Wicked Witch. Captain Nemo and the giant squid.
Well, Beth said, whatever the reason, you saved my life. Thank you.
Anytime, Norman said. He smiled. Just don't do it again.
No, I won't be going out again.
She brought back a drink in a paper cup. It was syrupy and sweet.
What is this?
Isotonic glucose supplement. Drink it. He sipped it again, but it was unpleasantly sweet. Across the room, the console screen still said, I will kill you now.
He looked at Harry, still unconscious, with the intravenous line running into his arm.
Harry had been unconscious all this time. He hadn't faced the implications of that. It was time to do it now. He didn't want to do it, but he had to. He said, Beth, why do you think all this is happening?
All what?
The screen printing words, and another manifestation coming to attack us.
Beth looked at him in a flat, neutral way.
What do you think, Norman?
It's not Harry.
No, it's not.
Then why is it happening? Norman said.
He got up, pulling the blankets tighter around him. He flexed his bandaged knee. It hurt, but not too badly.
Norman moved to the porthole and looked out the window. In the distance, he could see the string of red lights from the explosives Beth had set and armed. He had never understood why she had wanted to do that. She had acted so strangely about the whole thing. He looked down toward the base of the habitat. Red lights were glowing there, too, just below the porthole. She had armed the explosives around the habitat.
Beth, what have you done?
Done?
You armed the explosives around DH-8.
Yes, Norman, she said. She stood watching him, very still, very calm.
Beth, you promised you wouldn't do that.
I know, I had to.
How are they wired? Where's the button, Beth?
There is no button. They're set on automatic vibration sensors.
You mean they'll go off automatically?
Yes, Norman.
Beth, this is crazy. Someone is still making these manifestations. Who is doing that, Beth?
She smiled slowly, a lazy cat smile, as if he secretly amused her. Don't you really know? He did know. Yes, he thought he knew, and it chilled him.
You're making these manifestations, Beth.
No, Norman, she said, still calm. I'm not doing it. You are. 0640 hours. He thought back years ago to the early days of his training when he had worked in the state hospital at Borrego. Norman had been sent by his supervisor to make a progress report on a particular patient. The man was in his late 20s, pleasant and well-educated. Norman talked to him about all sorts of things. The Oldsmobile hydromatic transmission, the best surfing beaches, Hadley Stevenson's recent presidential campaign, Whitey Ford's pitching, even Freudian theory. The man was quite charming, although he chain-smoked and seemed to have an underlying tension. Finally, Norman got around to asking him why he had been sent to the hospital. The man didn't remember why. He was sorry, he just couldn't seem to recall. Under repeated questioning from Norman, the man became less charming, more irritable. Finally, he turned threatening and angry, pounding the table, demanding that Norman talk about something else. Only then did it dawn on Norman who this man was, Alan Whittier, who, as a teenager, had murdered his mother and sister in their trailer in Palm Desert, and then had gone on to kill 6 people at a gas station and 3 others in a supermarket parking lot, until he finally turned himself into the police, sobbing, hysterical with guilt and remorse. Whittier had been in the state hospital for 10 years,
and he had brutally attacked several attendants during that time. This was the man who was now enraged, standing up in front of Norman and kicking the table, flinging his chair back against the wall. Norman was still a student. He didn't know how to handle it. He turned to flee the room, but the door behind him was locked. They had locked him in, which is what they always did during interviews with violent patients. Behind him, Whittier lifted the table and threw it against the wall. He was coming for Norman. Norman had a moment of horrible panic until he heard the locks rattling, and then three huge attendants dashed in, grabbed Whittier, and dragged him away, still screaming and swearing. Norman went directly to his supervisor, demanded to know why he had been set up. The supervisor said to him, "Set up?" "Yes," Norman had said, "set up." The supervisor said, "But weren't you told the man's name beforehand? Didn't the name mean anything to you?" Norman replied that he hadn't really paid attention. "You better pay attention, Norman," the supervisor had said. "You can't ever let down your guard in a place like this. It's too dangerous." Now, looking across the habitat at Beth, he thought, "Pay attention, Norman. You can't let down your guard, because you're dealing with a crazy person, and you haven't realized it." "I see you don't believe me," Beth said, still very calm. "Are you able to talk?" "Sure," Norman said. "Be logical, all of that?" "Sure," he said, thinking, "I'm not the crazy one here." "All right," Beth said. "Remember when you told me about Harry, how all the evidence pointed to Harry?" "Yes, of course." "You asked me if I could think of another explanation, and I said no." "But there is another explanation, Norman. Some points you conveniently overlooked the first time. Like the jellyfish." "Why the jellyfish? It was your little brother who was stung by the jellyfish, Norman, and you who felt guilty afterward." "And when does Jerry speak?" "When you're there, Norman." "And when does the squid stop its attack?" "When you were knocked unconscious, Norman. Not Harry, you." Her voice was so calm, so reasonable. He struggled to consider what she was saying. Was it possible she was right? "Step back. Take the long view," Beth said. "You're a psychologist, down here with a bunch of scientists dealing with hardware. There's nothing for you to do down here. You said so yourself. And wasn't there a time in your life when you felt similarly, professionally bypassed? Wasn't that an uncomfortable time for you? Didn't you once tell me that you hated that time in your life?" "Yes, but when all the strange things start to happen, the problem isn't hardware anymore. Now it's a psychological problem. It's right up your alley, Norman, your particular area of expertise. Suddenly you become the center of attention, don't you?" "No," he thought, "this can't be right. When Jerry starts to communicate with us, who notices that he has emotions? Who insists we deal with Jerry's emotions? None of us are interested in emotions, Norman. Barnes only wants to know about armaments. Ted only wants to talk science. Harry only wants to play logical games. You're the one who's interested in emotions. And who manipulates Jerry, or fails to manipulate him? You, Norman. It's all you." "It can't be," Norman said. His mind was reeling. He struggled to find a contradiction and found it. "It can't be me, because I haven't been inside the sphere." "Yes, you have," Beth said. "You just don't remember." He felt battered, repeatedly punched and battered. He couldn't seem to get his balance, and the blows kept coming. "Just the way you don't remember that I asked you to look up the balloon codes," Beth was saying in her calm voice. "Or the way Barnes asked you about the helium concentrations in Esil." He thought, "What helium concentrations in Esil? When did Barnes ask me about that?" "There's a lot you don't remember, Norman." Norman said, "When did I go to the sphere?" "Before the first squid attack, after Harry came out." "I was asleep. I was sleeping in my bunk."
"No, Norman, you weren't. Because Fletcher came to get you,
and you were gone. We couldn't find you for about 2 hours, and then you showed up yawning.
I don't believe you, he said.
I know you don't. You prefer to make it somebody else's problem. And you're clever. You're skilled at psychological manipulation, Norman. Remember those tests you conducted? Putting unsuspecting people up in an airplane, then telling them the pilot had a heart attack, scaring them half to death? That's pretty ruthless manipulation, Norman. And down here in the habitat, when all these things started happening, you needed a monster. So you made Harry the monster. But Harry wasn't the monster, Norman. You are the monster. That's why your appearance changed, why you became ugly. Because you're the monster.
But the message, it said, my name is Harry.
Yes, it did. And as you yourself pointed out, the person causing it was afraid that the real name would come out on the screen.
Harry, Norman said. The name was Harry.
And what's your name?
Norman Johnson.
Your full name? He paused. Somehow his mouth wasn't working. His brain was blank. I'll tell you what it is, Beth said. I looked it up. It's Norman Harrison Johnson. No, he thought. No, 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 she can't be right. It's hard to accept, Beth was saying in her slow, patient, almost hypnotic voice. I understand that. But if you think about it, you'll realize you wanted it to come to this. You wanted me to figure it out, Norman. Well, just a few minutes ago, you even told me about the Wizard of Oz, didn't you? You helped me along when I wasn't getting the point. Or at least your unconscious did. Are you still calm?
Of course I'm calm.
Good. Stay calm, Norman. Let's consider this logically. Will you cooperate with me?
What do you want to do?
I want to put you under, Norman. Like Harry. He shook his head. It's only for a few hours, Norman, she said. And then she seemed to decide. She moved swiftly toward him, and he saw the syringe in her hand, the glint off the needle, and he twisted away. The needle plunged into the blanket, and he threw it off and ran for the stairs. Norman, come back here! He was climbing the stairs. He saw Beth running forward with the needle. He kicked with his foot, got upstairs into her lab, and slammed the hatch down on her. Norman! She pounded on the hatch. Norman stood on it, knowing that she could never lift his weight. Beth continued to pound. Norman Johnson, you open that hatch this minute!
No, Beth, I'm sorry.
She couldn't do anything to him as long as he remained here. Then he saw the metal pivot move in the center of the hatch between his feet. On the other side of the hatch, Beth was spinning the wheel, locking him in. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.